Hi, I'm Alistair, the editor of Wilderness, and I'm joined by Paul Hersey to discuss the three trips that have changed his life. Paul has climbed extensively in the Southern Alps as well as many places overseas. He's a published author, with his most recent books being The High Pathways, a guidebook to mountain scrambles and snow climbs of Te Waipounamu, co-authored with his wife Shelley Hersey. The Cold Inside, a story about mountains, friendship and doubt, and Protection, his first work of fiction. Kia ora, Paul.
Good morning.
Before we get onto the three trips you've chosen, I wondered if we could learn about how you chose the ones that you did write about. Are there any kind of special ingredients maybe that go into making a trip life-changing?
It's different for each one. It sort of depends what sticks in your mind. I mean, each trip has its own, I guess, good points and bad points. And these three were really, strong for me at the time. And thinking back now, they still really stick in my mind as being really influential. So that's why I've chosen them.
Okay, well, shall we start with your trip to Kyrgyzstan? That was a foundational trip by the sounds.
Yeah, so this was back in 1996, and I was invited on my first overseas climbing expedition by an early mentor, Hugh Nicholson, who I'd done some climbing with in New Zealand. I was an absolute greenhorn at the time, and while we were over there, I was lucky not to get the team arrested by my desire to take photos of lots of different buildings through the cities we went through, and then by changing our currency on the black market, which didn't go quite as well as we planned. On our expedition in the base camp area where we were also held up by armed bandits, but couldn't really tell. They all seemed pretty low-key on it, so couldn't tell if they were serious or not. So, yeah, we kind of refused to hand over the money. The guys actually told me to hide the money on my body because I was the biggest person. So that worked out for the best. On the trip, I came to realize how slow I was at acclimatizing to higher altitudes. I'd only climbed really in New Zealand before then. But despite that, I still managed to summit three mountains, and including a solo rock climb, which felt pretty out there for me. But it also, I guess, really made me realize the desire I had for tackling things like that in the future.
So with that one, do you think was it the experiences of the nearly getting arrested, the bandits, or was it the climbing that was really the most important factor?
All of the above. It's certainly traveling through Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Not a lot of Westerners had gone through there at that stage, and so it was all quite new and quite tricky. But also the climbing, like it was much better quality rock than we had in New Zealand mountains. Also, I was much more fatigued before we could even start climbing because of the altitude. So that took quite a bit for me to, I guess, understand and manage.
So that was your first time at altitude?
Yes, it was. Yeah.
You mentioned Hugh there. I'm just wondering how important is having a person like Hugh in your life when you're a greenhorn climber?
It's hugely influential, and even like now when there's so much, I guess, social media stuff about traveling fast and light and everyone climbing at their limits, having someone who's been there and done it before just kind of lets you know that that's not necessarily the right way for everybody, like building a good groundwork of easier climbs and just sort of some of the basics. People that have done that before can just make it all seem a bit more reasonable. It's not sort of either all or nothing. You know, there's a lot of grey areas in mountaineering especially, and having someone with that experience can just kind of help ease you through that.
How did you end up being mentored by Hugh?
He actually approached me. I was living in Whangarei at the time, and he moved up there for some work, and there weren't a lot of rock climbers up there, and he actually tracked me down because I'd put some new routes up on some of the limestone up there. And so we started rock climbing together. Then we both moved away. And we just kept in touch and did some mountain stuff together. And then this opportunity for this expedition came up. So,
in your description of the bandits, you seem a bit kind of blasé about it all. But a few years later, some American climbers were actually taken hostage or kidnapped by rebels in Kyrgyzstan. And I just wonder, in hindsight now, thinking back on that, was it maybe a little bit more serious than you realized at the time?
Yeah, possibly. Yeah. We actually went back and climbed there about a decade later, and the political situation had changed considerably. We actually had an armed escort from the Kyrgyz army going in, and then the Tajik army, the Tajikistan army, because you pass through a small area of Tajikistan to get into this valley, they were waiting for us at the border, and so we actually detoured around that to get out. So yeah, things had changed a lot. I still feel probably in my gut, it was just a couple of local shepherds just trying it on, you know. They thought all Westerners were Americans, and so they thought that they were all rich, and we weren't, obviously. So yeah, I feel like it kind of still was that, but you know, they kind of had the gun in the general vicinity of us, but they didn't kind of rock up and point it in our face, which obviously I would have handed the money over then if they had.
Classic. All right, Paul, can we go on to your Mount Hopkins trip?
Yeah. So that was the next one, and as my climbing progressed, what really drove me a lot was, I guess, striking aesthetics of particular mountains. And there was a photo of the north buttress of Mount Hopkins in a guidebook to the area done by Ross Cullen. And it was an amazing photo. And I knew that it hadn't been climbed and it had been tried a bunch of times. It's an 1,100 metre long rock route, which is particularly long for New Zealand mountains. And so I knew that I'd have to find a pretty strong climbing partner to go and attempt it with. And so I managed to convince Kinnan Basley, who'd done a bunch of climbs and we'd done quite a bit together, to go and try it in the summer of 2006. It was a big climb. It's still the longest, most challenging alpine rock climb that I've done. I guess what sticks in my mind is, for us to get it done in a day, we had to solo a chunk of it. You know, it's, if you pitch something like that, you know, it's 40, 50 pitches. So we soloed be close to 2/3 of it. And I got into a bit of a flow, I guess. You're just kind of moving once you realize that if you fall, it's all over. And if you manage to let go of that, you just kind of move through this terrain. And it's not being flashy or that you're thinking you're gung-ho. It's just, I guess, a quiet confidence in your own ability and in your climbing partner's ability of moving with rather than against the environment. It's certainly something that I have loved about mountaineering, being able to get into that state. I don't always manage to get there. Quite often my nerves or my conservative kind of climbing attitude get in the way. But yeah, when I do, I certainly embrace it.
I tried to find a photo of the North Buttress of Mount Hopkins, but I didn't see one. Can you describe the picture that really kind of captured your attention?
Yeah, it's... So with alpine rock in New Zealand, the aspect of it is really important, so that you're on a weathered side, so that it's not kind of like Weet-Bix, the old grey wacky. And you could see from the photo that it was on that side. It had been glacial worn, but it was also just the length of it. You know, it was such a long face. It was sort of double anything else in terms of rock, alpine rock that I'd climbed. And so a sense of scale was difficult to get, but looking at the map, you know, and you go, well, that's over a kilometre high. there's a whole lot of climbing ahead of us. So, yeah, what kind of kit to carry? But, yeah, it still sticks in my mind now. I can still see it. I mean, it's an aspect that you can't see easily from other mountains.
A kilometre just sounds phenomenal. How do you prepare for that?
Yeah, we carried overnight kit. And it was quite heavy what we did carry. We also had to carry two ice axes because it was quite steep snow around as well, and double ropes because if you had to abseil off stuff, and a fair bit of rack. So up high, the climbing was still quite challenging, not at a technically high grade, but super exposed. Knowing it now, I'd carry less, but of course I've done the climb, so I know that I can move through it quickly enough, whereas we just didn't know how much we'd have to pitch and how much we could solo.
Let's move on to the Honey Badger. Paul, that's your third trip that changed your life.
Yeah, and this was in the winter of 2011, and I was climbing with my wife Shelley and a good mate Graham Zimmerman. The weather had been a bit scratchy up the Hopkins Valley further up, and so there was a sort of an area of water ice that I'd seen from the valley floor near Rabbiter's Peak, and we decided to go in and have a go of that. As was typical, I sort of struggled to overcome my nerves at the start of the climb. I'm a particularly bad starter of climbs in the mountains. It takes a little while to get in the groove. And so Shelley, she stepped up and she led the first pitch. I jumped on and led the second pitch, and there was no gear on the pitch. It was completely clean. And so I was hunting around at the top of it, out of sight of Shelley and Graham, trying to find somewhere to put ice screws in that were going to hold, or some rock anchors. And so I managed to just build the anchor and clip into it. And then seconds later, chunks of ice came off from overhead. I was knocked out. You know, you're just getting pummeled and you don't think a whole lot until you're not thinking anymore. When I came to, you're only half making sense of stuff. I couldn't hear the others. I had no idea what had happened to them further down. I managed to re-rig so that I could abseil. I only had one hand that was working properly. When I got down to the others, they were also injured. Graham was pretty bad, and we just needed to get off the climb in case more ice and snow was going to fall on us before we could sort of assess ourselves too much. And we did. We managed to get everyone off and get to a nearby hut before I hobbled out to the road and found someone with a four-wheel drive who came in and could get the others. And then we drove ourselves to, I think it was Timaru Hospital. There was a lot about, I guess, self-reliance and self-responsibility that day. I guess those are key learnings that we took. And for me, they've remained, I guess, essential building blocks to my own climbing philosophy about looking after myself in the mountains.
You say chunks of ice came down. I'm just wondering, I mean, how big are we talking here? It's not little bits of ice skittering down, is it? It must have been a substantial fall of material.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't looking up at the time. All I knew was that I'd literally just clipped the anchor, and then next thing, stuff was hitting me. So it's not a whole lot of assessment going on. I just kind of cowered down and made funny noises until next thing. Then I came to, and there was a bit of blood around, and yeah, I had a sore head, obviously, and sore ribs.
And the other two, were they worrying about you at this time, or were they concerned for their own safety, you know, busy looking out for each other lower down?
Yeah, well, Shelley was blaying. She was slightly off to one side, and Graham was just starting to come up to me, so he was in the full path of it. So he got hit by what I got hit by, and only worse, because the debris sort of had another 50 metres to accelerate and to hammer him. Whereas Shelley kind of got clipped off to one side. But yeah, all three of us, I mean, we were super lucky. If I hadn't just managed to build and clip into that anchor, I would have gone two pitches and probably pulled their anchor, and we would have gone the distance. So we'll take it.
Oh, it's so frightening. And one thing I wondered about this one, Paul, is that you were climbing with your wife, and does something like this change how you handle risk in the mountains, or even whether you want to risk things in the mountains when you're climbing with someone that's obviously very special to you?
Yep. We chose not to have kids. it wasn't just that, but certainly we both were committed to climb, and yeah, that we thought it would certainly be unfair. So yeah, you cut into the chase. That was one of the defining things where, it was unfair. We, you know, who stays at home and looks after them? So we both wanted to climb. So that was certainly something there. I mean, there were take homes. It was probably a bit warmer up high. Things might not have been quite as well, obviously weren't as well locked down, but stuff comes off in the mountains from time to time. You know, there's been other times when I've been in just the right place at the right time. Shell's had stuff land right beside her. That's mountaineering. I mean, it can happen, you know, in all walks of life, but yeah, it just obviously focuses your thinking for a bit with mountaineering.
You mentioned the nerves on that climb, but you also say that you're often nervous at the start of the climb. Why is that?
I guess with my risk management, it's I kind of think of it as the positive power of negative thinking. So I think of what can go wrong and then how I can mitigate against that. But sometimes that gets just a little bit much at the start before a climb. And, you know, my climbing partners generally know that. And so they're usually really good about leading the first pitch. And then I usually get in the groove and we carry on. And sometimes if I've got a climbing partner and they haven't felt the drive either, then we've turned around and gone home, you know, and that's okay. That's mountaineering. You don't have to get up stuff all the time.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you about that. So you will turn around if it's just not feeling right for the two of you?
Absolutely. Yeah. We've failed on much more than we've succeeded on for various reasons. I mean, there are climbs that probably if I'd driven a bit harder, we probably would have got done. But you never know, you know, you either get to the top or you get cleaned up if it's bad conditions. And that's, I guess, part of the joy of mountaineering is being out there and having to make those decisions in an environment that you don't fully know what's going on.
Have you ever made the decision to not climb based on you're just not feeling right before leaving home even?
No, it'd normally be sort of weather-based, I would imagine, from leaving home. It'd be more when we're up there and we're walking in. And, if I'm just feeling super twitchy about stuff. And it might be other things going on in my life that get in the way. It has nothing to do with the climbing. That's okay too. I don't have to rock up and get it done all the time. I've sort of, as I've got older, I've grown more comfortable about that. I don't beat myself up about it, probably like I used to. I just, you know, shrug my shoulders and go, oh, yeah, okay, and on we go.
Well, thanks so much for sharing your trips that changed your life with us, Paul, and for talking about them with me today. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me.